It's December 3rd. It's Tuesday. More snow. Up early. Shoveling. But again, my neighbor was out there and he just shoveled up my driveway. God, I love you, John. Anyway, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. I mean, this is, I'm just telling you, everyone, it's why you love living in a community where people have your back. It's just, If we did this for everyone, the world would be different. Because people would show kindness in ways that are random and wonderful. And it's those random and wonderful acts of kindness that change people's relationships. I even think it changes the chemistry in who they in their bodies, in their heads, in their minds. I just, oh, my God, I want us to be nicer to each other. And then I got to hear Donald Trump this morning in England at the NATO summit. And, oh, my God, what he said about Adam Schiff was he's just disgusting. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. It's just there's a level of inhumanity and grossness and harshness that is just it's hard to cope with. And even though it happens 10 times a day and it's been happening since he got elected, even before then, I can't adjust to it. I'm glad I can't get used to it. I shouldn't get used to it. I need to be aware of its evil every time he opens his mouth. Remember that, everyone. Right. It is wrong. It's wrong.
In fact, that's one of the biggest problems with Donald Trump's presidency is that he numbs us to this kind of hatred and dividing people.
It's awful.
And it's me against you, and I'm better than you, and this is the biggest crowd ever seen in the history of the
planet. Nobody did anything right until me. I am the only one. He really does describe himself in these godlike terms, like there was nothing until me. You know, and until I existed, you were all suffering. But I have now arrived.
You said you don't know what to do with this horror show that's coming from Trump and Washington. I view it sort of like, I don't know, maybe I'm watching too many mystery shows, police shows. But if the authorities are investigating some major crime, I remember seeing a great show about a girl who was raped and nobody believed her. Mm-hmm. I think the name of it was Unbelievable. And nobody believed this young woman. And she changed her story because the police pushed pressure on her. But anyway, the point is, in investigating those kind of things, you have to – you got to not dwell on the horrors of what happened and just sort of keep focused on going forward. In this case, the impeachment inquiry is going forward. The electoral process is going forward. He's going to be out of there. God willing, the planet will survive till he is out of there. But we just got to keep not getting ourselves distracted by his horrors
it's this rabbit hole.
Keep doing what we need to do to stop him, including stopping individual policies, whether it's the border policies with the migrants or his racial hatred or his misogyny or any of the other stuff that he spews, his crazy tariffs that are killing a lot of people economically, and he thinks he's doing a favor for everybody. But, you know, we just got to keep our eyes on the prize. And speaking of keeping our eyes on the prize, what I wanted to talk about is today is the anniversary from December 3rd, 1965, so it's 54 years, when an all-white jury in Alabama convicted three Ku Klux Klansmen for the murder of a white civil rights activist named Viola Liuzzo. And she was just a housewife from Detroit who saw on TV these horrors that were going on, the way the police were abusing black demonstrators and obviously not allowing people to vote. They were segregated and the dogs were turned on the children's march. And Mrs. Liuzzo, this white housewife, goes down there like I would have done if I were old enough probably and volunteers to help because it's just the right thing to do to help.
And
it's
the, wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the immigration stuff today where I just can't stop from thinking, even if what I do is not really going to make that much difference, just everybody has to be doing something to heighten awareness and to get this to stop. Just stand up and say no. So anyway, she was the mother of five children, and she was driving a young black activist named Leroy Moten back to the town of Selma after a protest march. They had gone to Montgomery, the state capital, for a protest march, and she was driving him back to Selma. And the Klansmen came up behind the vehicle and stopped them and killed them. And could have been me, could have been you, could have been anybody. And still, it's got to be done. So these three, amazingly, these three white Klansmen were convicted. But there was another Klansman in the car named Gary Thomas Rowe, who, it turns out, was an FBI informant. And so, wow. You know, the FBI was had infiltrated the Klan.
This reminds me of the movie, The Black Klansman. Oh, my God.
Knew what was going on, knew what they were planning to do, and sort of watched it happen. I don't know whether he participated himself, the FBI agent, but he knows what's going on, and this stuff continues to happen. And I suppose his testimony may have been what convicted them. You got to do whatever you can do. I got a text from a friend about the border, the immigration issue, and she said what I really believe, that we're at a turning point, and we can either look away and let these horrors happen and sort of take it for granted that it's going to happen, or we can stand up and say no. And we've just got to do the latter. And that's what so many people are doing nowadays, and just got to keep doing it.
Well, to a large extent, I keep thinking that silence is a form of acceptance.
Yeah.
And we can't be silent.
Right.
And we can't be silent. And I go back to that little boy at the bar mitzvah where they asked him, what did he learn that year? And he said, I learned that doing right is hard.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just going to tell you, I get it. It's hard. It's scary.
It's easier to be quiet, to shut up.
It's easier to look away. It's easier to be quiet, to avert your eyes. But in the end, the foundation that you have laid by doing that is of greater evil and greater consequence. And therefore, you can't. You just can't.
Right. And but that's what the Republicans in Congress are doing, actually.
Right.
You know, it's hard to stand up to this president. So I think I'll just not stand up to him. I'll just let him do his thing.
Yeah. All right. Well, we need to grab our guest.
Call our guest.
Tomorrow, the beginning of the hearings in the Judiciary Committee on impeachment. And we've actually not spent a lot of time talking about impeachment, although it sort of seems to be pervasive in every aspect of our lives right about now, especially if you're people like myself and Ken. And David Schultz is an attorney. He's a professor at the Department of Political Science at Hamline University. He's a professor at the School of Law at the University of Minnesota. He is the author and editor of more than 35 books and 200 articles, which means he just spends way too much time thinking. But that's a good thing, I guess. And I called David up at Hamline, and I said, David, let's talk about impeachment. And sure enough, what does he do? He sends me a curriculum entitled Impeachment in a Nutshell, with historical documents and the law and the introduction and the congressional rules and resolutions and about appeals. And I mean, I've got the entire course really in my hands right now. And I know that David is not going to be capable of giving us the entire course from his impeachment in a nutshell. But that means, if nothing else, there isn't any question he can't answer probably. And I don't even know if I have questions, David. And the reason I say that is that how do you have an impeachment when you have one side of the political aisle deciding that facts have no meaning, there is no such thing as the truth, that that they will be in collective denial and they will follow their leader off a cliff because following is more important than finding the facts and finding the truth?
You're absolutely right, and it speaks to something that we should be talking about, which is the fact that we oftentimes reference that our American government is broken. The impeachment process is completely broken. My students, I have been talking about that when the framers created the impeachment process, they did it at a time when what? The senators were appointed by legislatures, which means they were supposed to be more independent, and B, when political parties didn't exist and polarization didn't exist.
Right.
Now, fast forward us 230 years later, where we have highly partisan world where, you're right, the concept of checks and balances and separation of powers is now subordinate to what? Partisanship, and the impeachment process is essentially broken also.
I interviewed a professor, Sandy Levinson, from Texas, and he wrote a book called Fault Lines in the Constitution. And it's not that he doesn't admire the people and the framers and the Constitution, but he just basically says it's a document that's not workable today, that no matter how brilliant they were and how many things they anticipated and how much of a living document this is, it could not in any way, shape, or form envision a situation that we're in today, everything from Fox News and the echo chamber to this instant gratification of social media to the amount of money that pours into the system to the influence of the Russians or whoever else to a president like Donald Trump who doesn't really care about the Constitution, who has no respect for the rule of law, who is so off the charts when it comes to anything. I mean, even on drugs, nobody could have imagined a Donald Trump because he just doesn't fit into anything that we have seen historically, Republican or Democrat, Nixon or Clinton. I don't care who you're talking about. But he is just so unique in such a frightening way.
No, you're right. So the two points I will respond to. One is the argument, and I think you're absolutely correct, Don, that, and I just say to my students, our Constitution was drafted in a horse and buggy era before we had any of the technologies, any of the world that we live in right now. It was also a document that was forged out of significant compromises over slavery and a whole bunch of other issues that really have limited its ability, I'm going to argue, and Sandy Levinson, who also teaches at UT Austin Law School, makes this argument, that basically are living with us to this day. And so his argument is that there were flaws in it initially that become magnified over time.
Exactly.
I agree with that and say that we really can't sort of jerry-rig it anymore to the present. But the other thing that I think our Constitution presupposed, even though it assumed that we have all these checks on power, checks and balances, separation of powers, et cetera, it still assumed that there was some background consensus in belief in the integrity of the process and in belief in the Constitution. And that's the part where I think it's not just Donald Trump, but increasingly we're seeing Mitch McConnell and the Republicans, you know, in the Senate, that these core constitutional norms that really have held us together, they just don't seem to respect them or care about them anymore, and they're going to put party loyalty, they're going to put fidelity to Trump ahead of everything else.
So what's the point? No. I mean, this is so scary to me because I feel like we're living on two separate planets. I also saw an interesting article. I think it was at The Nation, but it was also at CNN. They had done a poll in mid-November about the sort of people's thoughts going into impeachment. There was a 21% differential in the gender gap.
Mm-hmm.
That 61% of women wanted him impeached, and that it was 40% of men. So this is like on another level, I feel like there is so many things that are pulling us apart, including things like gender on top of all the other things, partisanship and everything else. I'm just trying to figure out, how does a democracy survive, Dave? Even if the Democrats win in 2020, what are they winning?
Yeah, they win a Pyrrhic victory, and
yes,
they win a victory of which we're going to see, which has happened several times in, let's say, our lifetimes, where the Democrats have to come in and clean out the barnyard mm-hmm. that was created by the mess of Nixon or by the mess of Bush and so forth like that. And so they spend 3 or 4 years having to do that. And that's what I think we're going to see this next time also, is a Democrat having to clean up the barnyard at this point, or clean out the barn and do the exact same thing. And it's not going to be easy because, you know, as I said to my law students, and the last day of class was yesterday, as I said to them, crackpot legal theories that all of us would have dismissed 3 or 4 years ago now get credence and are being talked about as if mainstream, you know, arguments that say that presidents don't have to turn over their taxes or that presidents don't have to allow their senior staff to appear before Congress, or that presidents can just divert money that's been congressionally appropriated to other purposes. But case law is really clear on this stuff, that the president should lose, but he may not, because unlike with Nixon, where we had the Supreme Court backing up Congress and the American public, unlike even with Clinton, you know, even though we can argue over the merits of the impeachment there, the courts sided against the president. I'm not sure this Roberts Court, when push comes to shove, is going to go against Trump. And that becomes one of the dangers we should be talking about down the line also, is that Trump has effectively packed the Supreme Court and the lower courts for probably a generation.
And I want everyone to remember that the court, the most important court is not the Supreme Court, although we'd like to think so. It's the Court of Appeals, which are like mini Supreme Courts all over the United States. And so while we're sort of all lighting candles that Ruth Bader Ginsburg survives, take a look at what he's done to the Court of Appeals around the country. And that's where the bulk of the cases are going to end up. And he's already packed those. So it's not like, you know, everyone keeps looking at the Supremes as if that's what, you know, is the place to focus on. Not that I don't care about the Supreme Court. I desperately care about the Supreme Court. But you have to know how much he has moved into the court system in a way, at a speed, with the kind of reactionary judges that are so young, they're probably still teething, that, you know, they'll be here for generation after generation. And that is, I think, what's so scary about this. And I know Ken wants to weigh in, and I'm going to toss to him. But David, I'm just trying to figure out, knowing that if the Democrats do win, they have to clean out the barnyard. But they have to clean out the barnyard as there is a level of urgency and angst and fear and inequality and climate change, that how do you clean and move forward? It is a beyond comprehension enormous task, beyond comprehension. And I'm not even sure that anyone is capable of doing it.
Yeah, we may already be over the tipping point on some things. For example, the climate change issue. The others, you know, I don't have a good answer to how you do this stuff either. And I only can invoke a little bit of hope. And I say this to my students, that in the early part of the 20th century, we had big businesses, corporations, and trusts, large chunks of money ruling the United States. And somehow we figured out through the progressive era to clamp down on many of those things, and it worked for quite a while. Right. And I want to hope that we're going to have like maybe a second coming of the progressive era, where we yet again tackle these big issues and figure out how to solve them. Because at the end of the day, I don't think we're a stupid country. I don't think we don't care. It's getting the right people at the right time and getting the American public to say it's time to do something, much in the same way that we did in the early teens of the 20th century.
I know. Ken, you wanted to weigh in.
Yeah. When you were talking earlier, Dave, I was thinking, how is it possible that somebody who's trained as a lawyer like these judges can think the way you've just articulated, that it's okay to just go with Trump and not have the guts to uphold the law? You know, it's only in the Nixon era, when U.S. v. Nixon made it very clear that the Supreme Court was going to back the rule of law over something that helps an individual president. And now I'm scared to think that you're right, that the current justices and appeals court judges might just not even care. And how can anyone feel that way after going through law school? It's mind-boggling.
Well, have you met Bill Barr?
I mean,
it's just, you know, and I was listening to, what is it, John Kennedy, the senator from Louisiana, who is a Rhodes Scholar or whatever. I mean, I am looking at these people, and if you look at their bios, Dave, you are just overwhelmed. They're smart. They've gone to the best schools. Yeah. They're scholars here. They're scholars here. And then you hear what comes out of their mouth, and I'm thinking, what scholarship for? Like, what is intelligence for if you choose to use it in such a way that it is both manipulative and dishonest?
Yeah, but isn't that the power of privilege? I mean, you're right. They went to the best schools, the prep schools, the Ivy League schools. They're relatively clueless to what real America is like. They're also what? Part of the boys' club. They're part of this small, insular bubble of their own that reinforces their own ideology and worldview. And what's changed in the last 20 to 25 years, or maybe 40 years going back to Nixon, is the degree to which now the Republicans, and the Democrats haven't figured this out yet, to the degree to which the Republicans understand the importance of the judiciary and have made it a top priority in terms of screening them. The Federalist Society, which is kind of almost like a cult club for the right-wing, you know, judges in this country, has become very powerful. And so they have figured this out. I mean, one of my faults, for example, of Barack Obama, when he took office, he never made a priority by filling the judgeships. This is way before, you know, Mitch McConnell started to block him.
Right.
And I think the next Democrat has to figure out how to do what? Fill those judgeships. And let us say the Democrats, you know, take back, you know, the presidency and take back the Senate. There's a lot of things they need to do, but I would put at the top of my priority filling those judgeships, because that's the greatest legacy now in terms of presidents, and it's going to determine the scope of what presidents can do and not do. And again, this has been one of my faults, or one of the faults, I think, for the Democrats for just too many years.
So let me tell you what the Republicans have as an advantage over the Democrats, and it's called Roe v. Wade. Why do I say that? Because the evangelical Christians know that they were basically forced to embrace abortion, not because of a legislature, not because of a Congress, but because of a court. So they have what the Republicans have is not only an echo chamber within the evangelical Christian movement, but they have a demand from them. So they have been able to frame that if you want us with you, the thing you fix is the courts. They don't care about policy. They don't care about the president. They care about the courts, because that's where they basically see, look, we got gay marriage. Oh, my God. Look, we got abortion. Oh, my God. Where did it basically come from? They look at the judges and they look at those black robes and they say, we want our people there. So it's not just the GOP came to Jesus on this. They were really sort of encouraged by the evangelicals that they pander to. Let's be honest. They wanted their support. They needed their support. And the best way to get it was to deliver on the judges.
But at least in the early days, the judges, I mean, I remember when Rehnquist and the Nixon court were in control, and at least they falsely, in my view, but they made arguments as to why they were still following the law when they really pushed the boundaries of the law kind of beyond comprehension. But nowadays, the judges don't even seem to care about explaining something in the context of, you know, stare decisis, upholding precedent, or within, due process. It's like whatever we want to do, we can do. And by God, we've got the power, we're going to do it. And that's what I mean, Dave. I just can't imagine people graduating from law school and really having that approach. It's sort of like people who are president of the United States and don't think they have to obey the law.
A nice analogy here. Yes, I mean, one of the, you know, again, I'm a political scientist and a law professor, so I live in two different worlds. And one of the things that law schools don't like to talk about is politics. You know, they like to ascribe to the idea of legal neutrality and that judges, you know, stand above the law. But we, again, increasingly we know, and again, we've talked about this just a second ago, that because of the way especially Republicans are screening judges, that in many ways now the judges have become what? As I say in class, they've become politicians with ropes. You know, for all the criticism that Republicans used to do of the Warren Court, and claiming that Warren and the liberals were what? Legislating from the bench or something like that. I mean, we have evidence that shows that this Supreme Court is one of the most activist and one of the most conservative courts we've had since the beginning of the 20th century. And the Republicans have been working at this for what? Literally since Nixon, to flip the court. And they've succeeded in doing it at this point, and flipping the lower courts, too, in the process.
You know, I just heard something, and I got to go see if I can find it. They were talking about Clarence Thomas, and that Clarence Thomas is now coming out attacking Joe Biden for what happened when he was appointed to the bench. And again, I feel like, oh my God, you've got Clarence Thomas, you've got Donald Trump, you've got him threatening the Ukrainians. I mean, it's unbelievable what's happening. But that you talk about this court being political, when Clarence Thomas suddenly starts talking about Joe when Joe is running for president, when Donald Trump is president, it just becomes like the synergistic effect of there are no boundaries anymore.
Well, also, if it weren't for Joe Biden, Clarence Thomas wouldn't be on the court.
I know, exactly. But
I know.
But to attack him now is just—it's just kind of shocking at this level. So, as you're teaching these courses on impeachment, is this is I'm just trying to figure out what will be accomplished, because we know he will not be removed in the Senate. Is it right. really about talking to the 8% of Americans that may still be somewhat engaged, that may be somewhat aware, that aren't predisposed to making a decision, and for them it is the layering of the facts that they hope they will sort of begin to understand means that they have to remove him through their vote?
It may be directed to your right, to those 10% of the swing voters and a small number of swing states that are going to really decide the election. And that's really what's going to come down to. Now, I'm going to sketch out a different scenario. And I was thinking about this yesterday in teaching this class and said to my students, given everything where we are right now, I increasingly think what the House ought to do is not impeach, but censure him instead. Yeah. And the reason why I would go with that route is that once it goes over to the Senate, if they do to impeach, it's going to be a carnival and circus beyond belief, and they're going to what? They're going to put on all the conspiracy theories. They're going to put on. They're going to call Hunter Biden to testify. It's going to be it's going to be all about Biden. And then I sketched out a different scenario. I said, imagine a scenario where, let's say, Elizabeth Warren or one of the Democratic senators, whichever one of it is, gets the nomination. Let us say Mitch McConnell says, "Well, heck, I'm not going to hold a trial right away. I'm going to wait to hold a trial until when? About November or October."
And I'm going to lock
Elizabeth Warren down for 3 weeks in the chamber. So she can't go out and campaign. Do you want to bet a quarter that he wouldn't do that?
Oh, no. I got to let you go, but I have a real quick question. So censure begins and ends in the House.
Correct.
Okay, that's all I need to know. I need to make sure I understood that. So they can be, he can be censured, but once the decision for censure, then it doesn't get shoved over to the United States Senate.
They can do a one House censure, and the beauty of that right now is the fact that since Trump is not going to participate in the impeachment proceedings or send anybody, he doesn't get to tell his story. He doesn't get to refute them, at least in a formal proceeding.
Wow.
And so the House votes the censure. Then. Because what I'm worried about is the debacle that will occur in the Senate, not just in terms of him being acquitted.
But the timing. I got to let you go. Dave Schultz, I love you. You got to join us again. Now that you're not teaching anymore, you're calling us back. Okay.
Right.
Hamline University, Political Science, Law School, you name it, he does it all. All right. This is The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. A Little Labor History is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1946. That was the day a general strike erupted in Oakland, California. Workers, mostly women, had been on strike for a month at two downtown department stores. Teamsters honored their picket lines and refused to make deliveries. Infuriated owners of Hastings and Conn's demanded their merchandise and turned to the city for help. And on this day, police assembled early in the morning to clear the streets of picketers. They attacked strikers, forcing them off the street and setting up a perimeter of machine guns to escort scab delivery trucks through the line. One striker recalled, "I was black and blue for 6 months from their clubs." Outraged truck drivers, bus drivers, and streetcar operators all stopped, got out of their vehicles, and joined the strikers, quickly filling downtown Oakland. By the end of the day, the city was completely shut down. 142 AFL unions called for a labor holiday in support of the strikers, and now 130,000 workers were on strike in solidarity. UAW member Stan Weir recalled that it was the bus drivers, many just returned from the war, who led the strike. The streets that night had a carnival-like atmosphere. War vets led a march to City Hall to demand the resignation of the mayor and city council for their attempts to break the strike. The general strike quickly forced the administration to stop the scab herding. But local labor leaders were divided over what some considered a near insurrection and called the strike off 54 hours later. The retail workers were left to fight on their own for another 5 months. But for a few days, workers got a taste of their own power. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
America's good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
My theme song. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. The title of the piece, Which Side Are You On? By Monsieur Ken?
By Rob? The Dropkick Murphys.
God, what a great song. What a great song.
Well, it really is. That's what we got to decide now.
Yeah, which side are you on? Speaking on which side, I think I'm on Robert Hennelly's side. The reason is that every time he writes a damn piece at Salon.com, what he doesn't know is like either 48 hours or 24 hours before I read the piece at Salon.com. I've put up a tweet or I put something up on Facebook that in a very pithy way is basically what he writes about in such an eloquent and articulate way. And I'm thinking, God, we're channeling each other, Robert. All right. So first of all, who the hell is Robert Hennelly? He has written a reporter for The Village Voice, Pacifica Radio, WNYC, CBS Money Watch. Oh, God, you are so important. He is now a reporter for The Chief Leader, covering public unions and civil service in New York City. You can follow him on Twitter at Stuck Nation. He also regularly writes for Salon.com. And so he sent me his piece, as I had eyeballed his piece, and it was entitled Obama Pines for the Political Era That Created Trump in the First Place. Americans don't want to tear down the system, Obama said. Has he seen the system lately? And it's just amazing, Bob. I had literally been commenting on exactly that, and then I read your piece, and I'm thinking, holy moly. I mean, it is kind of interesting how the Democrats are so afraid of change. They're so terrified of it. And when they, you know, they want to go back to the good old days, and I'm thinking, really, the inequality days, the days where we didn't address climate change in a rational way, that we didn't have, you know, affordable housing, that are the cost of, I mean, it's just, you kind of look at that going, everything you didn't fix, you want to go back to? I don't think
so. Wall Street is all that matters.
Exactly. So welcome to the program, and let's talk about your reaction to his comments.
Wow. Well, you guys have a lot of energy up there in the middle of the day.
Absolutely.
I would say that this is one of these things, because the social media response is always instructive after something like this.
Yeah.
So it's important to preface this by saying that I have great respect and for the former president, and miss the grace with which he acquitted that office.
I totally agree. Amen.
That said, I went from, like, in 2008, I had the good fortune of interviewing him here when he was in the primary. I was working for WNYC Public Radio, and it was in his interest to try to do as solid a job as he could, running against what was, you know, Hillary Clinton. This was her turf. And so in that interview, asking him about things, I asked him directly about, you know, what if it turns out in bailing out Bear Stearns, we're bailing out an ongoing criminal enterprise. And he was very polished in his answers, but I got the foreshadowing that when it came to this issue with banks and with trying to hold accountable the financial sector, he was going to have a problem. And, you know, he always, what's interesting, if you go back and look at how he packaged himself and, you know, the way he talks about history, he mentioned Ronald Reagan a lot more than Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And the times required an FDR.
Yeah.
And that's not what we got. And so at this pivotal point, and there's a great book, by the way, by Ron Susskind called The Confidence Men, which I highly recommend, where
Mr.
Susskind was given a really total access in the first couple of years of the Obama White House. And that's what's chronicled there is how Mr. Geithner and Mr. Summers really tried to prevent President Obama from doing the things that he had said he wanted to do, like break up one large bank. Mm-hmm. And much of the reporting in that book, which is just great, it needs to be recirculated now, was the way that these two guys who were such friends of Wall Street and of Capitol wanted to make sure to try to keep Elizabeth Warren as far away from the president as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we have here is that there was a turning
point. No, I want to remind everyone, she was not in the United States Senate. She was a professor at Harvard.
Right.
She was worried about the bankruptcy bill. She was the driver behind the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Right.
She understood what banks were doing. She understood the consequences. Therefore, they needed to put a moat around Obama because, God forbid, she swam the moat.
Right. That's great. Oh. And so one of the things about this is that in the years since, and this is the thing, too, like, everything that I'm talking about now is based on granular reporting. So when I'm talking about the impact of the failure of the President Obama to step up, and you know, he sided on the side of Wall Street and their pattern and practice fraud. This is, but the follow-up is based on me going to places where this failure, this betrayal, really of working class families. Happen in places like Cleveland, where there were 6,000 empty homes, or in Newark. You pick the inner city and the legacy of that failure to stand up for people on Main Street or Martin Luther King Boulevard is with us today. And the problem is that the corporate news media, which is driven by Wall Street, does not want to reflect on the wholesale failure of our late-stage vulture capitalism.
Right.
That is the thing they can't countenance.
Right.
That's why they tell you that things, there's a recovery. They keep, like a mantra, repeating the stock market up and down as if it has anything to do with the mass of Americans.
Right.
When today a smaller fraction are involved in the market than certainly was true before 2008. And so this continued slide of the economic circumstances of the American people is creating some very perverse things. And one of the things that happened
Trump.
Was that in these 200 some odd counties, we talk about them, and in several key states, people that voted for President Obama in 2008 and 2012 either stayed home or in just a small tens of thousands voted for Donald Trump, and the rest is nauseating history.
So let me just read a couple of lines from your piece, which I recommend. I have it posted on Facebook. I sent it out. I'm going to repost it on Facebook anyway. You write, President Obama's decision to bail out Wall Street at the expense of the poor and working class had generational consequences. The destruction of trillions of dollars in family wealth accumulated over decades coincided with an ever-accelerating concentration of wealth that has only worsened under Trump. And I think this is just so important. Again, it's kind of like if I ever ran for office again, my whole thing would be do the math. Do the math. And if you did the math in the 2008 economic meltdown, and you did the math in 2019, or you did the math right before Donald Trump got elected, you would begin to understand the anger and the resentment and the sense of abandonment and the sense that what they noticed were the people that actually destroyed the economic fabric and the economic system. And not
right.
only were they forgiven, not only did they not go to jail, they were loaned the money so they could get back on their feet. And, oh, good, they paid it back. That's like me robbing a bank and saying, not a problem. I just needed to borrow the money for a while, but I'll pay you back with interest. They'd still go to jail. They robbed the freaking bank, you know? And it's just amazing that we are somehow able to sort of distort, you know, what we saw and what happened. I mean, I posted your article on Facebook and people kept saying, oh, but they paid us back with interest. I said, they stole the money. Oh, God.
Well, and that's also, I think, that folks don't sometimes don't grasp what happens to the real-time value of money. And so,
yes, thank you.
If you are a family, and
thank you.
I did a little radio documentary on a couple that were displaced as a result of their parents' homes being foreclosed on, and they ended up living their car in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are just millions of people to this day whose lives were framed by that betrayal and mm-hmm. still can't get traction. I mean, the irony is, this is just not reported, is that while African-Americans gained the symbolic victory of an African-American in the White House, many of them lost their own home. And these homes took generations to get against all odds of redlining. And so this kind of shirking of the shoulders, like, well, this is what we had to do, just is not based on granular reporting. Had there been a moratorium, had they just paused so that there wasn't this kind of collapse, what ended up happening was they destroyed housing values across the country.
Right.
Because what ended up happening was is they forced people out of their homes. Often the banks, it wasn't that they flipped them or sold them. They just drove people out of them, and they fell to ruin in what really has to be described as a crime against humanity. As the number of homeless people and displaced families grew in the United States.
Right. You know, it's interesting, and I want to connect the dots to something you said about the redlining and how it took them the challenge of even getting to home ownership. There had been so many barriers, so many impossibilities to doing it, and yet for those that did, the sense of accomplishment was overwhelming, and the devastation of losing it was beyond comprehension. And you know who I think about? I think about Cory Booker. Cory Booker tells a phenomenal story, everyone, about how his parents got their first home. And they got their first home in a white neighborhood. And when they were going to buy the home, they were told that, oh, the home wasn't available. And then they sent in like a straw buyer who happened to be white to go in and buy the home. And they were saying, oh, not a problem. Let's sign the papers. And then at the day of the closing, who shows up but Cory Booker's family? And they go, what the F? And sure enough, and I just want people to know, that story that Cory tells, that is not unique. That is not unique. This is what it is meant to be redlined. This is what it's meant. And this is a guy who's running for president who can tell that story. He also happens to be what? Black. You know, I mean, so in a lot of ways, Bob, we almost need to connect the dots to what happened after the 2008 economic meltdown and what happened to so many African Americans. Not only were they devastated after finally getting to goal, but they're still devastated. They have not been able to regroup. They are still beyond comprehension when it comes to their lack of wealth compared to whites. It's just unimaginable.
And actually, the deterioration of this is further compounded by what's happened to the generation. And this is all zip codes, all races. The saddling of the generation, the millennials, and even just in the general population with over $1.7 trillion in student debt is on top of, you know, we've talked before in this show that from the 1970s on, wages were flat or declined.
Right.
And what capitalism did is replace that with ever larger amounts of household debt. And so people had the illusion of prosperity, but with this crushing burden of debt. And really, we have to look at debt as social control.
And
I think that, and so what's happened here is that you have young people, right when they need to be actualizing their dreams, working dead-end jobs to pay for dead-end degrees based on the fact that this country disinvested in them. And I think we need to look at the wealth that was created historically in this country when we made education for free,
right.
When the GI Bill is an example.
Right.
What happened in City College and around the country where municipal, county, and state institutions were free, the amount of wealth generated by that investment in human capital was transformative. And we have to get back to that because that disinvestment has resulted in the things we also talk about. We now are in a country where life expectancy has declined 3 years in a row. We keep saying it over and over again because it should be the lead of the news, but it's barely a footnote in the corporate news media.
So, or in the political media.
Anywhere. That is the problem. So this is so interesting that you say this. So there was an article at the Atlantic Monthly. I'm hoping to get the author of the article as well as someone for responsible consumer lending. But here's the title of the article because it goes directly to what you say, Bob. God, I can't stand it. I think we're separated at birth. Anyway, the title of the article is Freedom is Meaningless Under Insurmountable Debt. Let me read that headline again. Freedom is meaningless under insurmountable debt. You talked about that this kind of debt is social control. This is another form of prison without bars. It limits opportunity. It limits choices. It means you are, that's what I love about, you know, people who talk about mobile homes and mobile home parks. I said, no, you're a captive tenant. There's nothing mobile in a mobile home park, except that, you're basically sort of controlled by the person that owns the park. And the insurmountable debt, whether it's student debt, think of all the things that you can't do because of your enormous student debt. You know what I used to call? I wrote a piece for the Concord Monitor, Bob, about 5 years ago. And the title of the piece was about student debt, and it was called The Anti-Dowry. All right. I want – nobody talks about it this way. This is a form of prison. It is a form of prison. I mean, at least in prison, you can get three squares. Maybe not necessarily healthy, but at least you get three meals. You could be outside of prison with insurmountable debt, and you could actually be hungry. You could actually not have a warm place to spend the night because of what? Because of debt.
Well, and then also I think it's important to reflect back when – education was relatively less expensive when we were having subsidized and free education was during the anti-war period. And how did that work out? You had young people doing things that they believed in and marching, and it was very messy. It's much better to arrange for them to be very busy working their dead-end jobs, paying off their debt that they'll never satisfy.
So how do we thread the needle? Because you started this show by basically saying, I voted for Obama twice. I miss his eloquence and his stability and his politeness. We use the word polite. That's the one word I thought was so cute the other day. I heard a woman from Iowa talking about Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And she said, why does she like him? She said, I see that, oh, my God, he could be my grandson, and he's so polite.
I would say civility. I think polite's a little condescending.
Yes, I didn't say that.
She said that.
Right. But it is civility, and there's a yearning for that. That when Barack Obama talks about going back, that is the first thing that comes into my head. Oh my God, someone who won't spend all his time trashing everyone, and using every four-letter word, and basically making sure that every conversation is fact-free, and just going back to something other than that seems like perfection. But as you point out in your article, if we just go back to that, we will actually lay a landscape for Donald Trump to return again. And it may not be him, but it'll be a version of him, because all we have done is basically fail to address the problems that gave rise to him. And, you know, as people keep saying that, you know, what is it, Nancy Pelosi can do two things at once. She can pass an agenda that's, you know, progressive and enlightened, and she can also impeach Donald Trump. Well, I want the next president of the United States to be able to return to civility, but at the same time to understand that there are so many urgent things that need to be addressed, that moderation doesn't get us there.
Well, and I would say there was some data points that are important to keep in mind here is that things, I understand the President Obama hearkening back to this kind of halcyon notion, but the reality is that when he left, there were some 45 million displaced refugees. I think the latest numbers are that there's 75 million wandering the earth. All of these things that were unaddressed have only accelerated. And so the consequence of global warming, which the President Obama tried to make a start on, but the reality is all of it has progressed. And this time with Donald Trump, I would put through the frame of a lost opportunity cost. Not only is it destructive, but it means we've lost this time. Right. And so there has to be a a kind of laser focus and accountability. And quite frankly, if you don't have an agenda, and I think a labor organizer mentioned this to me, is you have to inspire people.
Yes.
It's not like just settle. I think people now really need to feel that they're part of and can actualize a transformation because they see it all around them. And we got to this place by looking backward, because remember, that's what
exactly
Donald
right.
Trump, right?
It He's was led
reflective.
Us backwards.
It was,
yep.
Right, make America great
again. You know, it's so interesting. So I remember when I was running for governor, and someone said, well, what's your inspiration? And my inspiration were a lot of Scandinavian women who were prime ministers and everything else. And my inspiration was the former governor of Vermont, who was just an amazing woman. And I remember saying to a reporter once, if you can't dream it, you can't become it.
Right.
And what I think is so important about an agenda that is not sort of wallpaper, that is not moderate, that really sort of pushes us to imagine, is that we have to go there. We have to go there. We may not accomplish Medicare for all. We may not accomplish, you know, zero net, whatever it is for climate change, but we'll never even get halfway if that isn't where the goal is. Because we've already understood that compromise keeps dragging us back. And given where we need to go, we have to compromise by going to Mars, not to the moon. You know, because I mean, and that's where we have to go. Because that's the nature of compromise. It's where you begin and end that you find a middle. But if you start at the middle, you never get to a place where you know you need to ultimately go.
Can I go from that, Bob, to a question? How do we get there? Because it really concerns me, as I'm sure it does you, that the corporate centrist Democrats are doing such a great job of demonizing the Sanders and Warren agenda of visualizing real systemic change. And what can we do? What can anybody do to prevent that from happening and to stop people from saying, oh, yeah, we like that Obama good old days of civility, if you will, and no
Which
progress
we
when
like,
we, still,
but it's not enough.
We still bail out Wall Street first.
Right. But I think that one of the things here is to create and to nourish new networks that are authentic and occur mm-hmm. to you every day in your life.
Right.
So that you make a point of not wasting any time in your daily conversations to make and to reach out of your comfort zone to speak with people about your circumstance that you normally wouldn't interact with.
Yeah.
And that then has a kind of energy to it. And then also, I mean, I'm seeing something here. I'm speaking to you from City Hall in New York City, where something unthinkable has happened in the last few weeks, which is the staffers of the city council. All right. These are people that provide support for, you know, some 50 some odd elected officials are in the process of unionizing.
Wow.
And this came as a result of serial sexual abuse that was substantiated against members.
Mm. Wow.
Things that have been going on for years.
Decades.
So it's important that you look at your workspace, right. your 40-hour a week circumstance, if you're fortunate to just have a 40-hour week, that that's a place you can make change through your social network, through your unaffiliated time, but to make sure that you're connecting with people. And like I say, the key thing is outside of your comfort zone, because one of the things that's happened is a consequence of our current moment is a tribalization where people are, through social media, it's easy to speak with people that reinforce your values.
Right.
And the only way to build a transformative coalition is to fight that and create an authentic connection.
So, Robert, I was taken off of commercial radio. And one of the reasons, years ago, about 2006. And one of the reasons I was taken off commercial radio was that I would be raising questions about the car industry, and I would raise questions about the pharmaceutical industry, and I would raise questions about the insurance industry. And I want to remind everyone that who pays the ads? The
right.
car industry, the pharma. And so, therefore, it wasn't about listenership. It wasn't about, you know, approval by my radio audience. It was about the fact that they went to the boss and said, get her off. And as I'm thinking about that, I want to point out something about Medicare for All. You know why there seems to be such an incredible poo-poo of Medicare for All, but people at CNN and MSNBC, is because guess what? Who buys the ads on MSNBC? Who buys the ads on CNN? Big pharma, big insurance, and this is all about dollars. They understand the connection. There is a profit motive to healthcare today, and that profit motive isn't just to the insurance executives and the insurance industry and the big pharma. It is also a profit motive that now is fed into our cable news network and into the reporting that we get. So please understand, nobody has ever said to Mika and Joe about the connection and done the math of how many pharma ads are on there 2 or 3 hours, how many insurance ads are on there, and if we had Medicare for All, that revenue disappears.
Well, and
there's a connection.
Well, I think that this actually accounts for some of the resistance and headwinds that Senator Warren ran into related to her embracing of this universal care model. One of the things that happened in all the debates and continues to happen is that all the questions that come out of the corporate news media are couched in the Republican light kind of critique.
Yes,
how would
exactly.
you pay for this?
And on that note, I need to let go. Robert Hennelly, go. Thank you so much. Go to him at Stuck Nation. He's a reporter for The Village Voice, Pacifica Radio, WNYC, CBS. He is now a reporter for Chief Leader, which explains why he's in the basement of City Hall. Thank you so much.
On the first floor.
On the first floor. Okay, he's moved up. All right. Thank you so much, Bob. Take care. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. We played Which Side Are You On? So I got to pick another song. I'm trying to figure out what I should do. I know. I'm going to play with what Bob actually told us to do, which is what Aretha tells us to do all the time.
Think.
There you go. Change.